As we said yesterday, it's easy to imagine that we have left real life behind somewhere else, and we're coming here to get away from our real lives, to learn some things, to download some things, and so forth. Like, that's an illusion. This is your real life. And the question is, what is God doing in the room right now? Because this is the only time you have. You're already thinking about this afternoon. You don't have this afternoon. You don't have yesterday. And so even what's happening in the room in between the time that I'm up here doing my thing is really, really good and rich. Lots of conversation, connection, and so forth. My invitation is for us to pay attention to this. Make intentional use of it. Breeding more and more and more connection, which of course evil despises. You know, like, evil doesn't want you here. Evil doesn't want you paying attention to this stuff. Evil don't want you acting on it. You know, we said, for those of you who weren't here yesterday, we said, you know, the statistics on these things are not good, right? Probably at best, probably only about 10% of you when you leave are actually going to do anything about what you've learned here. And as we said yesterday, like, oh my gosh, like, I hope I'm not part of the 90%, right? But it's just a fact. I mean, it's just because we are pushing against so much. Things that are both within us, things that are outside of us. Look, you live in a world that does not want integration to happen, as much as it says that it does, right? I was listening to an interview by one of the VPs at Google who thinks that real AI will be here by 2030, right? So machines who are acting and behaving like humans. Thinks he'll be here by 2030. And in the interview, he said on multiple occasions, they'll be smarter than us. Smarter, 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 smarter. On no occasion did he say, I think they'll be wiser than us. On no occasion did he say, I think that they will have convictions like us. On no occasion did he say, I think that they will feel guilt like we do. I think they will be able to repair ruptures when they occur. I think they will believe in God. I want to suggest to you, like, this doesn't make him a bad guy, but it does mean that, like, he's talking from the lens of a plausibility structure that is not the one that, out of which we're talking about this morning. Does that make sense? It's important to know. Most people in the world today are not trying to do the work you're trying to do that you're trying to do here. Narrow is the gate. Because it's really hard to do. Have we said that? Following Jesus is hard to do. I want to briefly draw your attention to something. You can see this at the lunch break and then at the break this afternoon. If you are finding any of this to be useful or helpful, I just want to let you know something that we're trying to do. When I say we, myself, my colleagues, we have started a small nonprofit called the Center for Being Known. You might see there's some information out there on a table. And this little Center for Being Known is, its hope is to take the material that we've been talking about and to scale this in a way that we can make this available for churches and groups, to train trainers, to develop leadership and so forth, who can help pay attention to these things, because we don't believe that the stuff that we're talking about here is just about your spiritual life. We think that the things that we're going to see later this afternoon, we think this is about all of life. And no matter what we're talking about, right, whether you're in church or whether you're in architecture or whether you're in engineering or whether you're a teacher or whether you're a painter, whether you're a cyclist, we really believe that Jesus is Lord of all creation. And we really believe that shame has infected everything. And we really believe that these principles of interpersonal neurobiology and Christian spiritual formation have things to say to every part of life. And so our hope is to develop a nonprofit that can make this available to more people, that isn't just limited to like my being able to speak about these things, but that as an organization, we can speak to organizations. And if you're interested in finding out more about that, I would encourage you, we have a, if you just want some information, there's a sign-up sheet where you can get more information from us out there. There's a table out there. And as well, if the notion strikes you to be curious enough, even about financially supporting the group, that's something that we, of course, would welcome. But mostly we would ask for you to be prayerful for us. And, you know, how many of us have ever, you know, we've been in these situations where people talk about their nonprofit or whatever, and they say, like, mostly we want you to be prayerful about it. And you think, like, yeah, what you really want is my money. I'm not cut out to run a nonprofit, which is why I'm not. Our executive, our managing director was here yesterday, and we have a small but really vital and eager board that's working. And they know that I'm not the guy to run this nonprofit. We need other people to do that, because that's not my gifting. But I will tell you that in the middle of this, I can tell you now that, like, prayer is what we need more than anything else. If you're trying to do this kind of work, you discover pretty quickly evil doesn't want this stuff happening. And you find out there are plenty of ways in which it works really hard against you. And so we're trying to do this at a pace that makes sense for us trying to steward this well. And so I would encourage you just to give a look-see to that table, some information out there if that's of interest to you. We do have a small, yes, we do. We have a small website, and that's the information that we'll provide for you out there. But thanks for asking. Luis, cue this up. So now what I'd like for us to do is, as we enter into this next time, we've been hearing some things about, with some preliminary things about how shame works in the body. We're going to hear some more things about this before we head into the afternoon where all the good stuff happens, right? But for now, I want us to even remember, when we find ourselves distressed, the invitation is for our memory to turn to the Jesus that is paying attention to us with delight. And so even as we continue this morning wandering through some of the mechanics of shame, I want us to do so with this in mind. Could you turn that up just a little bit? Thank you.
You say you see no hope. You say you see no reason we should dream that the world would ever change. You're saying love is foolish to believe, 'cause there'll always be some crazy with an army or a knife to wake you from your daydream, put the fear back in your life. Someone wrote a play just to glorify what's stronger than hate. Would they not arrange the stage to look as if the hero came too late? He's almost in defeat. It's looking like the evil side will win. So on the edge of every seat, from the moment that the whole thing began, it is love who mixed the mortar, and it's love who stacked these stones, and it's love who made the stage here, although it looks like we're alone. In this scene set in shadows, like the night is here to stay, oh, there is evil cast around us, but it's love that wrote. This darkness, love can show the way. So now the stage is set. You feel your own heart beating in your chest. This life's not over yet. So we get up on our feet and do our best. We play against the fear. We play against the reasons not to try. We playing for the tears burning in the happy angel's eyes. For it's love who mixed the mortar, and it's love who stacked these stones, and it's love who made the stage here. Though it looks like we're alone in this scene set in shadows, like the night is here to stay. There is evil cast around us, but it's love that wrote the play. For in this darkness, love will show the way.
Show the Way by David Wilcox from the album Big Horizon. I invite us to keep it in mind as we continue then to talk about how shame operates. We now have a sense of what shame does neurobiologically, this shearing effect of when we are moving along with our sympathetic drive and the parasympathetic activates and the engine decelerates and no attuned relationship intercedes. And we see that it doesn't just have to be with the 2-year-old. It can be the 42-year-old sitting in the boardroom, sitting in the elders meeting, offering an idea that is dismissed. It can be the married couple where one goes silent. It can be the friendship where someone just stops talking to one another. It can be the classroom where the student is summarily humiliated or where the teacher is summarily humiliated by the principal. Or the principal is summarily humiliated by the visiting parent who's not confident about their school getting their child into Yale. It's everywhere. Part of why it's everywhere is it is early out of the gate. So this is one of the features that we see about it. It's early out of the gate. Shame can be experienced by a child as early as 15 to 18 months of age. Right? The child doesn't have to have language. Right, because it is primarily a neurobiologically sensed phenomenon. Children are picking up this sensation of shame in our houses, which means we've been practicing it a long time, which means we've been practicing learning how to cope with this for a long time. It's early out of the gate. And we all have memories of this happening to us or us doing this to other people. Our daughter Rachel, who, thanks be to God, is a pastor despite her father. Tell people, like, if it weren't for their mother, our kids would be, like, dead or in jail. This is what... Our daughter was about 2.5, 3 years old. I'll never forget it. It was a Saturday morning. And I was going to be heroic. And I was going to make sure that I was up early this Saturday morning. I was going to let Phyllis sleep in because I wanted sex that night. I'm kidding. I'm just trying to be, like, honest, okay? Fortunately, my wife is sitting at a table with a bunch of friends, so it's all okay, right? Like, you know how we husbands are. And so, But really, I want her to sleep in, and I'm going to take care of Rachel, who's our small child, and I'm going to get breakfast ready for her, and I'm down in the kitchen, and the house is quiet. And our daughter starts to come down the steps. I hear her coming down the steps, but immediately what I hear her come down the steps, you know the play school like cassette recorders? Technology of the devil. Because as a 2.5, 3-year-old, like she knew how to turn this thing on at like the loudest it could go. And it's at like 7:30 in the morning, and she comes bouncing down the stairs with this play, with this thing playing. Some, you know, of course, some like Bible song or something, right? Like, of course, it's gonna be this. She comes into the kitchen and she's coming in with her sympathetic drive, welcoming the morning, and I lose my mind. And I say as loud as I could to make sure that my sleeping wife could hear me, like, something to the effect of, you shut that off, turn that off right now, what are you thinking? And immediately, like you see it in the face. And I said, you get back upstairs. Right, like, dude, like, no sex tonight. And you sense it and you feel it. And this is what we do. Now, fortunately, you know, I have kids who, even now as adults, are really quite effective at repairing ruptures. But this is what happens, right? We, in our attempt to regulate our distress, right? I'm trying to do the right thing by making sure that we have a quiet house for the morning. And in so doing, I literally lose my mind. But I don't just lose my mind by myself, right? I take other people with me. And we would say that this would be an act of which I shame my daughter. And of course, it was almost immediately. I just felt awful, and I had to go back upstairs, and we had to kind of work through that. And she, to this day, says she has no memory of that event, for which I'm grateful, and I think that we're fortunate. But it's like, I mean, these things happen, and you, like, you can't believe that this is happening. And so it's important for us to know, like, these things are happening early for us. We've been practicing this for a long time, which I think is another reason why. It's significant that it shows up as early as it does in the biblical narrative, right? And they were naked and unashamed. Like, there were lots of other words, as we said yesterday, lots of other words that the Hebrews could have used to describe their emotional state in the garden. But they target this because of its significance in terms of how early it shows up and begins to do its work in the brain. And as we learned yesterday from neuroplasticity, those neurons that fire together, wire together, as we practice this, after a while, we're just doing it automatically and we don't even know the shame is at work. It's early out of the gate. And the first thing then that happens with this is this state of disintegration. How many of us, if you've ever had this sense of feeling ashamed, how many of us in that moment of feeling shame feel like, have a sense that it's really easy to think clearly? No. How easy is it for you to make a decision clearly? How easy is it for you to choose whatever the next course of action is going to be? To create, to move even. Because these different domains of integration that we talked about yesterday begin to separate, literally, in the brain, my vertical, horizontal, memory, consciousness, state, all these things begin to become literally, neurally disconnected from each other at the level of the prefrontal cortex. There are states of disintegration that are taking place. And in fact, we mentioned yesterday that, you know, secure attachment leads to highly integrated prefrontal cortex. There's a high correlation between secure attachment, between paying attention, between activating that attuned relationship that can withstand lots of emotional weather patterns. There's a high correlation between that and the integration of the functions of the middle prefrontal cortex, and there are 9 of them. Now, I'm going to give this list to you, but not as a list for you to memorize, but as a way for you to think about and to imagine what it is that tends to go offline when shame occurs. And the reason it's helpful to have this list is because it then gives us something to be aware of. We can ask ourselves questions. Well, gosh, how well am I doing this or this or this at the moment? So here's the first thing that we say, that attuned communication and a regulated and integrated middle prefrontal cortex first leads to what we call body regulation. Infants learn literally to regulate their bodies, right? When someone is attuned to them, when they're upset, they regulate their bodies, right? And we say that we are dirt, right? We are dirt and we are breath. We begin with dirt. And that dirt gets to be regulated by attuned communication. But that's something that tends to go off, like we feel things in our bodies that are now not very well regulated. The next thing that we talked about is fear modulation. We're able to modulate fear more effectively when we are attuned. But when we start to go down this road of shame, fear pops to the surface. It's very difficult for us to regulate and to modulate that. The next thing is attuned communication. I'm able to be attuned to someone else, and I'm also attuned to their being attuned to me. All these things that are having to take place in the middle prefrontal cortex. The next thing is emotional balance. And by emotional, what do we mean by emotional balance? My sense that I'm actually able to feel a range of different things and remain inside the window of tolerance. My emotion does not go so far off the grid that I drop into this sympathetic drive system where I either have to flee or fight. I have a sense of emotional balance. I'm able to respond flexibly. So response, flexibility. I can quiet myself. Like, this is what I didn't have on that morning on Saturday. I was not responding flexibly. It would have been better for me had I been able to say, just first of all, to walk over to my daughter. I still see it. She's in the kitchen. I'm like 15 feet away from her, and I'm yelling at her. To respond flexibly enough to say, I have to walk over and say, honey, can we turn that down because your mom's still sleeping? I didn't have that. And why was that? Because the reality was, in that moment, what's happening in my mind is that all of my effort to be kind to my wife was going out the window, right? I'm not enough. Somehow I didn't control for the possibility that my daughter might come down with a satanic technological device. But you see, I'm acting out of my own sense of inadequacy in that moment. Does that make sense? And I'm asking my daughter to carry responsibility for that. Oddly enough, the next thing is empathy. Empathy is a direct, learned function of the middle prefrontal cortex. Empathy is not like breathing, by the way. Empathy is an intentionally carried out human behavior, and all intentional human behavior must be learned by mimicry. I have to see it, watch it, or have it be done to me in order for me to learn how to conduct intentional behaviors. And empathy is one of them. And I'm not going to have empathy if I haven't had those first several things done to and for me. Insight. The capacity to actually see clearly and wisely and understand someone else's story. So to be empathic means I can feel what you're feeling. I can sense things. But am I able to make sense of things? Am I actually able to capture intellectually, am I actually able to capture cognitively a sense of what's going on here? Intuition. Intuition is not just something that some people have as gifts. That's also true. We have intuitions about certain things. But intuition is also something that we develop by practicing. Did we talk about perseverance yesterday? Right? Practice, 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 practice. When we practice things really, really well, after a while, we intuitively know things. We intuitively get things. right? We're Captain Sullenberger, intuitively making a decision that we're going to land this plane in the Hudson, right? Rather than try to do something crazy that's going to kill everybody on board, right? That's an intuitive maneuver. He doesn't spend a lot of time in the cockpit going through lots of algorithms. But that's because he has practiced. But we do this, remember, this development of the middle prefrontal cortex is always taking place in the context of community. These things we do not, like, we can't make this happen by ourselves. Like, it's not possible. We do so in the context of community that enables us to practice this together. And after intuition, we have morality, our capacity to have a moral conscience. Is one of the functions of the middle prefrontal cortex. All of these functions become disconnected from one another in the presence of shame, in the presence of deceleration with no clutch. And then what happens in terms of this disintegration? I'm not just disintegrated within my own mind, but that is also mirrored in my disintegration and disconnection from those outside of me. What is happening in my brain becomes mirrored in my relationships outside of me. I am separate within me, and I'm separate between me and you. Shame's very nature is such that when I feel it, sense it, I don't want to look at you, because my brain is anticipating that when I look at you, I will feel it that much more intensely. And so I don't. Disintegration, then, is a big deal. We don't just disintegrate. We also isolate and we hide, right? And after the fruit fest, the man and the woman hid themselves, covered themselves, right? Because they knew that they were naked. We hide. Anybody see it, ever see a dog be ashamed? See a dog, right? Right, that's not even a human being, right? And what does the dog do? Right? Eyes go down, body turns away, tail between its legs, right? What's interesting, too, is what we then tend to do in our isolation, because the text does not say, and they opened their eyes and saw that they were naked. Notice this. The text is a passive text, and their eyes were opened. And their eyes were opened. This activity of shame does something to us that is often beyond our own intentional regulatory capacity. Their eyes were opened. Not to mention the help that we get from other people, right? Here, let me open your eyes. Right? This notion that we are not only disintegrated, but we also hide from one another. Of course, I don't want you to see these parts of me, but frankly, I don't want to see parts of me. And so I practice not paying attention to them. So not unlike what I said yesterday, at a very early age in my story, I began to practice not paying attention to things that I wanted or desired or felt. Are you with me? Because to name them too closely anticipates that shame will soon be to follow. And I'm going to do everything I can to stay away from that. As we said yesterday, when left to its own, the brain will do everything it can to reduce distress as expeditiously as possible. It's only when we are the context of other people that we can choose to not reduce that distress quickly. Then there's this, I put this phrase in here, it's kind of odd, a movement toward stasis, which is a little oxymoronic, right? You're moving toward not moving, right? This word stasis, we said yesterday that movement is one of the category signposts of life in biological systems. Shame, by its very nature, activates that dorsal, that backside of the vagus nerve, non-myelinated, activated and very difficult to recover from. And one of the things that it does is it causes to not move. Everything from physically to mentally and cognitively, and certainly creatively. So when we got married, my wife was already a confident, accomplished skier, snow skier. And soon after we got married, she wanted me to learn how to snow ski. I'd never snow skied before, and I thought this would be a fun thing to do. And so we went up, we went twice, and she and a friend, and then we went with some friends of hers who regularly snow skied once a year. We were living in Pennsylvania at the time, and we thought it'd be a pretty good idea. And she figured that the best way to teach Kurt to ski would be just to put a pair of skis on him and take him up the lift. That was my lesson. No, no, she was really much more kind than that. She at least said, "You'll do this fine. It'll be fine, really, trust me." Because she figured because I was somewhat athletic, I could maybe pull this off. And I think that she was right to think this, because she's been skiing for years. I went twice. And on both occasions, I was wildly unsuccessful. Even with little lessons that you get, right, on the bunny hill, right? As if something's not humiliating enough, right? They call it the bunny hill. Why don't they call it the hill for those eager to learn? The hill for supreme risk takers. No, they give it the name of a mammal that can't keep itself safe from anything. You talk about shaming? Oh, I'll show you shaming. And you know, they have the little rope lift, right? They hold onto the rope and you're going, next thing you know, your legs are out behind you and the rope is dragging you up the bunny hill. My word. After two attempts at this, two trips, it was embarrassing enough for me that I decided I wasn't going to go skiing anymore because I just wasn't, I wasn't getting the hang of this. And like, who wants to go and just like voluntarily be humiliated? So I chose not to go. And she would, every winter with her friends, they would go once a year and they would go skiing. And within a few years, I mean, and she was very kind and would say, "Well, do you want to go?" No, thank you. I don't want to go this year. Within a few years, it was pretty clear that my narrative, the way I understood and told my story about skiing, had changed. You see, if I were being completely truthful with you, I would say, "I never want to be in such a humiliating position in my life. For the love of God, I'm not going skiing." But I didn't say that. After a few years, I just simply said, "No, I'm not interested." And this is the story that we tell ourselves, right? We said yesterday about how narratives can change over time. And we change over time as a way to cope with the realities of our lives. And in so doing, evil has its way. And you might think, "Well, God, Kurt, like you're like it's a little heavy-handed, right? Well, what's evil got to do with this?" When our kids were 6 and 9, and my wife turned 40, she wanted to, and her birthday is in January, she wanted to go to a really nice place to go snow skiing, like for a 3-4 day time. We're gonna go to Vermont. And we were gonna stay in a really nice hotel, and we were like, there's lots of snow in Vermont. We're gonna be in the east, so we're going to Vermont. By now, my kids can ski. You get the picture, right? What am I gonna be doing? I'm gonna be like sitting by a fire, reading a book. For 3 days in Vermont. Yeah, I came all the way to Vermont just to read. And so, as it turned out, as we headed toward January, and I am scared to death But I'm not just afraid, right? I'm afraid of being humiliated. There was a deal where there was a little ski area near where we live that offered this deal for lessons. And I was able to go for lessons. So I took lessons. But you go for like group lessons, right? But I went in the middle of the week. I was the group, right? It was so great because like I'm the only one there. I don't have to embarrass myself in front of anybody. And the guy who was my teacher, he invented skiing. I mean, he was this old. He was like, he must have been in his early mid 70s, right? Seriously, he was. I mean, he knew everything about it. But here was the best thing. Before we started, I kind of like decided he was going to behave like my priest, right? Because I started to confess all the reasons why I didn't want to be here and why this is so hard for me. And he had the patience to stay with me throughout this whole thing. And he would understand this, and he'd be like, yeah, no problem. We'll figure this out. We'll figure this out. This is hard to learn, especially if you're older. This is hard to learn. I'm like, I'm 38, Methuselah. That's so not fair, because he's not here. He's probably dead. Here's the point. He was a crucially important embodiment of someone who was able to absorb all the shame that I'd carried around this attempt at learning how to ski. And he took me, like a father takes a son, step by step by step by step. And a month later, I came back for another lesson, and it turned out I got the same guy in the same group lesson, of which I am the only member. The whole thing was of God, I'm sure. And we went to Vermont, and I had the time of my life, and now if I had the money in the mountain, I would ski every day of my life. But I would tell you, this is not just about practicing how to learn a skill. This is about what happens when shame wants to keep you static from creating. Let me ask you this. What acts of creation would you endeavor to take if shame were not part of the conversation for you? What risks of movement would you make if shame could not be in the conversation? What relationships would you engage if shame could not be part of the conversation? What conversations do we need to be having that evil does not want us to have, because it knows in the day that you do those things, the kingdom of God arrives. One of the other features of shame is that it is neurobiologically self-perpetuating. We feel shame, and then we feel shame for feeling shame. Right? We know how this works. One of the differences between shame and guilt is the following. It's often said that, and there's been really great research that's been done on guilt. You might be familiar with this. In young children, adolescents, adults, these words shame and guilt represent particular relational and neurobiological states that we enter into under certain conditions. Shame, as we said, happens very early. Guilt is a phenomenon that children do not begin to experience until they're somewhere between the ages of about 3 and 5. And the reason is because it requires their brain enough time to catch up and grow enough to be aware of the features that guilt also includes, which are, I have done something that is not just wrong. I'm not just feeling guilty because somebody says, like, wrong. Because, like, who knows what wrong is? I've done something that feels wrong, but that also has ruptured a relationship between me and somebody else. There is a relational cost to this. Guilt connects me to another person. My guilt, I've broken a rule, and you will be upset. You're my teacher, you're my parent, you're my coach, you're my this, you're my that. It relationally has me in a more advanced place. Moreover, here's the really interesting information about guilt. By and large, if someone commits an act for which they rightly feel guilty, and the act is committed against someone with whom they have a relatively safe relationship, a relationship that if it's fractured, they want to repair it, when we feel the thing we call guilt, our typical behavior is to turn toward the relationship in order to repair it. Guilt typically, neurobiologically, and relationally turns us toward the other. Shame does just the opposite. In the context of shame, we do not tend to turn toward the other. We turn away, which is why when it comes to shame, we have to have someone else come and get us. When it comes to shame, we need Emmanuel. We need Jesus coming to get us. We need God coming walking in the cool of the afternoon in the Garden of Gethsemane, in the Garden of Eden, and God coming to find Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus comes to find us and says, "What are you looking for?" It is self-reinforcing. And consequently, we need someone else to come and get us. One of the features of shame also that we're all kind of commonly aware of is the feature of condemnation. It's one of its hallmarks. The biblical narrative is full of the language of condemnation. It talks about this. All right? This sense that I am constantly now not even, like, it's so common for me that I don't even, condemnation doesn't have to be like language. I don't have to say, like, I'm a bad person. I don't have to say that. I just have to sense it. I just have to feel it. I feel condemnation within and about myself. And if I'm not feeling it within and about myself, I'm feeling it within and about somebody else. St. Paul captures this beautifully at the end of Romans chapter 7 when he basically says, the things I want to do, I don't do. And the things I'm not supposed to do, I do them. Oh, wretched man that I am, who will save me from this body of death? Right? Paraphrase, I'm screwed. Because there's something deeply wrong with me. And he immediately rolls into what many would consider to be his magnum opus, Romans chapter 8, that begins with this siren call. Therefore, there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. And we read that, and all it is words. I got a question for you. What if the last time something happened to you or you did something for which and of which condemnation was the hallmark of what you were experiencing, in that moment, you suddenly felt the hand of a 33-year-old Jew on your shoulder? In the moment when you've done your worst, in the moment when you're yelling at your daughter, who's brought a play school tape deck into the kitchen, he looks at you and says, I can't wait to see what we're going to do with the next 5 minutes. You're the guy that was made to be her dad. Let's go take care of this. I can guarantee you that's not what was going on in my head. And how many dozens of moments do we experience in which condemnation is the rule of the day? And therefore, we become living, breathing, embodied agents of condemnation. It's not just something that happens in a moment in time. It's something that I become. And Paul is reminding us, no. There is none of that. For those who are in Christ Jesus, well, what does that mean? We're going to talk about that this afternoon. Not just what does that mean theologically. You're all smart people. Nobody needs to educate you about that. The real question is, what does that mean in an embodied way? Our son Nathan, who's now 23 and in graduate school in London, had his own spiritual journey that was not unlike mine. When I was about 13 years of age, I'd had this remarkable encounter with Jesus. And about 6 months after that, I found myself in my house alone, screaming at the top of my lungs, because I was not sure that I could know for sure that the Gospel of John and all the other Gospels were true. Now, I got to tell you, there's something like maybe a little wrong if a 13-year-old is doing this, right? This is a little odd that a 13-year-old would be this distressed about wondering, like, can you trust the Gospel to be a true document? My experience growing up, as I mentioned earlier, was not one in which my parents were easily able to be curious about the parts about my own inner life that were most concerning to me. So conversations about my worries about faith were not things that I thought would be a good idea to have with a mom who was anxious, if you know what I mean. You learn this early and often. But by the time I was a parent, I swore that if ever my children had that same kind of an experience, I would be the man. I was going to be the dad that I didn't have. I was going to be the person who would have this conversation with them. I was going to be the person who, if they started to have their own questions, their own concerns, their own doubts, I was going to be the person who walked with them, who was with them, who let them know that no matter where they were, this is going to be fine. This is going to be okay. Our son was having one of those experiences in his early college years of serious questioning. This is a guy who is a man in which there is no guile. And this is a guy who, when he was asking questions about the gospel, was not just leaving faith or leaving the church. I mean, this is a guy who said, like, I can't really know that I can call myself a Christian if I don't really believe this stuff to be true. After he had had a serious experience with God in his mid to late high school years. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like, the opportunity is here. We're going to have a conversation and I'm going to be the man. And so it happens in his sophomore year. We're sitting at Christmas. We're having this conversation, just the two of us, in the middle of this long conversation. And over the course of that conversation, eventually it got to a point where the words that were coming out of my mouth did not go exactly like this, but the message that I essentially told him was, if you decide that you're not going to be a follower of Jesus, I think you're an idiot. And you know how it is? You ever find yourself in a conversation in which you're talking and you realize that the words that you were saying you should not be saying, and the more you realize it, the faster they come out of your mouth? And you're like, John Foreman's words, I'm losing ground and gaining speed. I don't know if up to that point I'd ever had a more painful awareness of my ability to inflict shame into somebody's life as I had. And my relationship with Nathan was one of the sweetest ones that I have on the planet. And there I was, pretty much doing to him what the Satan was doing to Eve in the garden, and giving him no place to turn. Two days later, he left for college, and I was sick. And for 2 weeks, I didn't sleep well. I couldn't work easily because we had this rupture that was toxic, and I was the cause of it. 2 weeks go by, and we have this long phone call. Because, and in the middle of that, like, I realized, like, you know, it's not even faith that I'm worried about. We can all, like, worry about what are our kids going to believe. Like, here, like, I got news for you. Like, Jesus is not worried about your kids. He's not. You think, well, he should be, right? He's not. He's not worried. He's too busy working. I wasn't afraid of Nathan losing his faith. I was afraid of me losing Nathan. I was afraid that if Nathan didn't believe what I would believe, it's not that I thought that he was an idiot. I would think that he would think that I was the idiot. Like, he's a pretty smart kid, and he's smart enough to perhaps know that there are things that I don't know, and I'm going to be the one who looks pretty stupid. This wasn't about who's right and who's wrong. This is about a fracture in relationship, which is what evil is all about. We have a long conversation 2 weeks later, and we begin the first steps toward repair, in which I said to him, I realized, like, this isn't about your faith. You can do with your faith what you want to do. This is about me being afraid that I'm losing you. And that I'm not enough to stop it. And mostly, I'm not enough to stop myself. Me, the psychiatrist, the elder in the church. Over the course of the next several months, every time we would have a conversation, I'm worried. And so I'm asking him, are we okay? He has long since said that he's forgiven me for my words. But that whole thing about shame continues to work, right? I'm forgiven of my guilt, but I still have the remembered sense of what I've done. In August, just before he left for a semester abroad, we had a conversation in which I said, are we okay? He said, Dad, we're okay, but we're not gonna be if you don't stop asking me this question. Now, the way this story ends is that a year ago at his graduation, we discovered that for a number of different reasons, through a number of different pathways, he has made his way into the community of faith, but not in the way I would have predicted. Of course not. But in so doing, he's made his way back to us, back to me. What shame wants to do is to convince you that when people leave, they're not coming back to you. That nobody's coming to find you. This is what condemnation does to us. When we think about shame, we usually think of it in terms of large catastrophic events. We mentioned yesterday that, you know, we mentioned if you're a female and you're in this room, your statistical likelihood of already having been sexually mistreated is about 3 in 10. The reality is that most of shame does not happen in large catastrophic events. Most of shame happens in the small, miniature moments that take place in the privacy of your own mind, moment after moment after moment after moment. I should have done this. I should have done that. I was stupid for having done this. I should never have trusted him. I should blah, 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 blah. It just happens over and over and over and over again. And after a while, it's happening so frequently that it's no longer a collection of moments. It's just an undercurrent of constant hum. Evil does not want us to be aware of actual events of shame. That would make it far too able to be exposed and dealt with. It wants us to live as if it is this rather constant undercurrent of very, very small things that we sense and image and feel that go on in the privacy of our own mind. And then we sense and image and feel that same condemnation directed not just to us, but to everybody else around us. In fact, it's so effective, we get to a point where we don't even know that it's happening. And last thing we would say is that it really is a harbinger of abandonment. So this is one thing that people wonder sometimes. It's like, well, is shame all bad? Isn't it? Don't we need it? Don't we need it to make sure that nobody, like, if we didn't have shame, we'd all be just like, you know, running around with without our clothes on, right? We'd be like, heavens to Betsy, right? Here's the thing. If we really did get rid of shame in all of its versions, in all of its forms, if we really got rid of it, you'd find that most of those behaviors that we would be worried about people enacting, if they weren't ashamed, emerge out of shame in the first place. If you really want to get rid of shame, you get rid of all those coping strategies that we create to cope with shame in the first place. But what it is really trying to warn us of, and in the garden, it was a warning that abandonment is around the corner, and it is not good for man to be alone. Shame is God's version built into the creation that tells us, like, it warns us that things are happening that are not going to be okay, really not okay. And the antidote for this, as we're going to see this afternoon, the antidote for this is not to run from it. The antidote for this is to turn toward people. The problem, of course, is that shame in and of itself, after we've practiced it for all these many, 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 many generations, the problem is we've practiced just running, 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 away, 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 away. And the very thing that we fear, abandonment, is something that we then enact. This is evil's victory. Farther and farther away we move from each other. Any of you who've read The Great Divorce, C.S. Lewis's powerful allegory about a journey of a group of people from hell to heaven, in the opening pages when he's describing what it's like for people who live in hell, right? They're building houses that are farther and farther and farther and farther away from one another. The less contact, the better. These are the features of it. These are the things that happen with shame that happen inside the privacy of our own mind. But what about this? I'd like for us to consider this. What if we were to take all those things that happen in the privacy of our own mind, all those comments, all those sensations, images, feelings, thoughts, and what if we were to take them outside of our mind and we were to place them in the form of an attendant? Each of us has, let's imagine for a moment that we each have our own private shame attendant. They're well paid, they're well dressed, they're up far earlier than we are in the morning, sitting in the same room with the Holy Trinity. And your alarm goes off, and you hit snooze 4 times. And the fifth time, The shame attendant is weaseling his way in between the Holy Father and the Spirit, and Jesus is saying, like, you've done it again. You're up late again. And then you climb out of bed, and then you walk to the bathroom where there are mirrors. And you look in the mirror, and the shame attendant is right there next to you. Another 5 pounds. How did that happen? Imagine the frequency. What would it be like if we were to externalize the gazillion number of things that we do in our head every day? If we were to externalize this and give all that and put that in the job of one other person, your attendant, whose job it is to be reflecting these things to you. Can you imagine? I mean, like, you've hired him. Like, what would you want to do? You might want to fire this person. You want to get rid of them. Heck, you might want to kill them. I couldn't. I'm a Quaker. I can't do that. I'd hire a Presbyterian. This is what happens when we start to actually pay attention to shame. This is exactly what evil does not want us doing. This is the first step toward healing. We like to say in the business that we name things to tame things. Just as Adam does in Genesis chapter 2 with all those wild animals, we name them to give them purpose and place. We name them as the first act of saying. To name something means I have to look at something. I have to identify something, which means to do so, I will no longer be afraid of you. I will name you for what you are. Something that we see that didn't really happen that easily, if at all, in the Garden of Eden. There was no naming going on. And then here's where we're left. I'm gonna take about another 5 minutes, and then we're gonna have some Q&A. If we're not careful with what this shame wants to do with us as individuals, what we get is how shame becomes systematized. You see, we come here as individuals in this gathering, and we're all thinking about this, how this applies to my life. But we have to remember that my life is not my life. My life is my life. And to combat shame necessarily must be done in the context of community, because that is where shame lives and breathes and has its being. In John chapter 9, we have a story. And it's like one of the more powerful stories for me in the Gospels. And the story opens with this comment. And as they walked along, he, Jesus, saw a man born blind. And if you know this story, you know that the first thing that happens when he saw a man born blind is that the disciples turn to him and say, what? Who sinned? And I'm thinking, like, dudes, like, you're missing the marketing opportunity, right? Like, why don't they turn to Jesus and say, like, oh my gosh, heal this guy, we'll have it on Facebook in 10 minutes. No, their first automatized reaction is, who sinned? This is condemnation writ socially. Like, we're programmed to just condemn. We're programmed to look for, whose fault is this? We're programmed to look for shame, to live it out, to drink it, eat it. Who sinned? This guy or his parents? And what does Jesus say? Neither this man nor his parents sin, but this man was born blind such that, oh my gosh, this is unbelievable, such that the works of God might be revealed in him. How many of us in our deepest moments of shame could ever imagine Jesus showing up in that moment and finding us and saying, this moment was meant such that the works of God might be revealed in you. Like, that makes no sense. Our brains can't get our brains around this. And I am telling you, that is exactly what God has come to do. He has come to find those places where shame lives most deeply and say to us, it is in this place where the works of God will be revealed. It is not in the place where everything is okay. It is not in the place where the well are, where the physician doesn't need to be. It is where those are sick that the physician is coming. It is in this place where you are blind and you are cast by the side of the road, given no job to do because you can't, taken out of your family, the scar and the sore on your family that you are, right? Because in the Jewish culture, if you're blind, that means that there's a problem with you because of sin, and there's a problem with your parents because of sin, and means like you're a problem for the culture, you're a problem for the community. And now this next part gets tricky, right? Because I'm the blind guy. And notice, like, throughout the night, like, he doesn't even get a name. Like, we don't even call him Joe, right? He doesn't even get a name. The blind man, he doesn't even ask for healing. Do you notice? He's the blind. He's sitting there. And the next, like, you're the blind guy. And the next thing you know, somebody's slapping mud on your face, which is what happens. And Jesus made mud from spittle and put it on the man's face. Echoes of Genesis chapter 2. And the Lord God made the man out of the dust of the earth. Something else, Jesus did not ask him for permission. Jesus saw him. The text says, and Jesus saw the man born blind. And Jesus did not ask for permission to come to find him. God did not ask us for permission to send Jesus. And I will tell you, at some level, we all think this is great news until Jesus shows up in the places where we are most broken and ashamed and says, I'm coming for this. Like the part of me who at age 54 didn't even know what I didn't know. And Jesus says, I'm coming for this. And so Jesus heals him, and then all the trouble starts. You would think that when the guy was healed, that he'd go back into his community, and they would say, Joe, you can see, and you have a name. But they don't. First, his neighbors are confused. Why? Because this all happened, of course, on a Sabbath. Right? Jesus is doing all kinds of things that we don't expect him to do. He breaks into our religious civilities. He is a disruptive technology. Healing does not happen without disruption. And now the neighbors are upset. And you think, like, why is this happening? And so they take him, naturally, to the elders. And now the elders are confused and upset because somebody has been healed on the Sabbath. And so we go from the neighbors to the elders at the church. And the elders then, they can't get the guy to, like, clarify, help them feel okay about their shame, right? Because you figure, like, if you're the community, this guy's been hanging around for a long time. And along comes this dude and heals him. And like, what are you left with? Like, I'm thinking like, gosh, what have we been doing for this guy's entire life? You with me? And so the elders call in the family. And the family can't answer the questions because they want to distance themselves because they know where this is going. They know how this movie ends. And they bring the guy back in. And they're going to inquire of him even more. And at the end, he like starts to play with them, right? He says, what, do you want to become his disciple too? Right? He's yanking their chain. And then they say this classic line. They say, you try to educate us. And then they answer the disciples' question. You who were totally born in sin. And they threw him out And not like threw him out, like out of the room, out of the church, out of the community. Now I'm thinking, I'm blind, but I've got 3 hots in a cot. I at least have a house that I can go to, despite the fact that everybody's kind of embarrassed about this. We've gotten kind of used to this, right? We've learned to tell this story differently now. I'm just a blind guy. I don't even have a name, right? It's like, oh, no, I'm just not interested in skiing. I want to tell this story differently, right? And now that I can see plain as day, I've got nothing. I don't have a community. I don't have a place to sleep. Like, I'm in deep trouble. Healing can do this. It can be terrifying for us to allow Jesus to walk into those places in our heart where shame dwells, because we have so situated our lives around making sure that shame is kept well hidden. Think of the people whom Jesus healed, not just of their infirmities, but also of their ultimate shame, who immediately find themselves in trouble. Think of the woman caught in adultery in John 8. He says, "Neither do I condemn you." Really good news, right? She looks up, everybody else is gone, and so is her job, right? Because he says, "Go and sin no more." How is she now going to pay for her? How is she going to pay to feed her kids? And now you've got a blind guy in John 9 whom he heals, who is totally dependent upon his community, who now can see, who now needs to work, but has no skill training. And I'm thinking, where was Jesus when all this was happening? Oh, sure. You heal me, and then you, like, go for a walk. And then what does the text say? Jesus, when he heard that they had put him out, came to find him. And of course, if I'm the blind guy, I'm thinking, like, I could have used you about like 30 minutes ago, right, in the trial. I want to suggest to us that Jesus coming for us is going to be healing of who we are and frequently disruptive of the communities that we occupy. John 9 is not primarily a story about the healing of a blind man. John 9 primarily is a story about how shame chokes a community. And that healing has its side effects. But the primary thing to pay attention to is that in the end, Jesus never fails to come to find us. Jesus never fails to come to find us. How many of us have parts of who we are that long for Jesus to come and find, but that we are equally terrified that he actually will? I want to suggest to us that as we have been building to this, that as we are to be Jesus to others, we are the ones who are coming to find others. We are Jesus' hands and feet. We are Jesus' eyes. We are Jesus' presence, as are others for us. As we turn toward this healing of shame and liberation vocationally from it. I'm going to stop with that. We've got about 15 minutes before lunch, and we have time for Q&A, and we're going to have people that are, people who have the microphones on the side. If you have a question, feel free to go to the microphone and take it up. Yeah.
Yes, hello. So my question is, when working with shame, are there causes of shame, like spiritual abuse, relational or attachment trauma, sexual abuse, that are more difficult to help heal? And then the second part of the question is, you talked about when the back half of the vagus nerve is activated and it just keeps firing and it's very difficult to shut off. Are there strategies to help shut that off?
The answer to the part one is yes. And the answer to part two is yes. And we will cover we'll cover part two this afternoon, right? Strategies for things. Part one, there certainly are different categories of intensity with which toxic ruptures take place, right? So toxicity can come in various levels with various levels of intensity. One of the things that we say about shame is that to the degree that shame is more intensified in its activation, we are going to need more time and more people. We need more time and more people, as we'll hear this afternoon, right? More time and more people. And of course, again, I can't overemphasize enough. We've said this yesterday multiple times. We live in an Amazon world. We want deliverance of our books and from shame by tomorrow at 4 o'clock, right? We do. It's very difficult for us to actually wake up to the reality that we're living on God's timetable and that certain things take a long time to heal. That's not to suggest that, well, we should just be willing to put up with that. But it is to say that for some of us who have been practicing living in shame for a long time, that's a lot of neural load to have to overcome, if that makes sense. But I want to suggest, as we'll talk about today, this afternoon, the news is good about where this is all going. So for all those things, spiritual abuse, trauma, so forth, yes, all those things can have their own more nettlesome forms of needing to be addressed. But I do want to assure us that the same basic function for what we need for that shame process to be healed is accessible, that we'll talk about this afternoon.
I have two questions.
Can you hear me? You have two questions.
You made a statement when you were talking about the humiliation with skiing. And what I heard you say was that you never wanted to go skiing again because you never wanted to be that humbled again and feel that humiliation. And that was your story. And then you changed your story to just saying, no, I'm not interested. And then I thought I heard you say, and that's evil.
And that's what?
That's evil.
Right. You probably didn't hear me say that. So is there a question?
Yeah. Why would that be evil to just say, I'm just not interested?
Right. What I would have meant when I said that's evil at work, meaning that we frequently, how many of us, like, again, I have elements of my story that are deeply tied to experiences of shame, and I don't want to remember that. I don't want to spend time there. I don't want to feel that. I don't want to sense that. I don't want to image that. It becomes far more emotionally palatable for me to tell the story wherein which I say, I'm just simply not interested, as a way for me to avoid what is really true about my story. What I'm saying is that Jesus comes not to help us avoid shame, but to confront it in order to address it directly. And so the way that I would have to really address that, as it turned out serendipitously, is what ended up happening. Me having to have this conversation with a teacher, like a ski instructor, who can then give me instruction without shaming me for all of my mistakes. Does that answer that? Yeah. And what I would say is that evil is hell-bent on getting us, just like he did with Eve, to tell the story differently. Right.
Okay, is this on at all, or do I need
to... Yeah, it's on.
Okay. You talked about attachment, and you talked about in this early infant when there's a lot of chaos and yelling and confusion about the child or things that are said. Can that occur, like, during the pregnancy, like in the third trimester, where a fetus actually feels all that, starts to feel shame because they are arguing, they don't want the child, whatever's going on.
Right. So the question is, in some respects, how early can this stuff actually start?
Yes.
Right. One of the things that we know that does happen, I mean, in order for infants to begin and even fetuses to begin to sense things, there has to be a neurological development. The neurology system has to be far enough along for the brain to be in an intact way able to sense those things. And so there is good evidence to suggest that from an implicit memory standpoint, how that infant experiences distress is possible to be done even before birth. That's what we would say. Whether or not that actually, we would put that in terms of shame or not is, that's probably a question we can't answer. Yep, you're welcome.
For parents, what encouragement can you give to parents who have a hyper-awareness of our ability to inflict shame onto those within our responsibility or sphere of influence?
So what encouragement do I have for parents who are really aware of how they're going to screw up their kids?
Exactly. Can you direct us to whatever? I don't know.
Right. So yes. Oh, nice. Nice maneuver. Nice. That's good. Just, that's right. Could you just please kind of like go into a fetal position under the table behind you? So the concern is of what, though? If I'm hyper-aware as a parent, your concern would be what?
Well, I think the point is it's debilitating. And so, therefore, it keeps you from possibly parenting or acting normal in an unnormal situation.
Right.
Because your hyper-awareness of the fact that
of the possibility that you might mess up your kids.
Yes.
Right, okay. So here's the thing. We say, well done. Well done. No, put that paper down. It is fine. Right, see the whole hiding thing. Okay, so, until I point it out. We're just gonna watch you walk right to your chair. Yep, there she goes. That's right, put the coat over you. Like, just put it over your head, it's okay. So this is a great question. And here's the really good news. The single most important variable that is in play in terms of your capacity as a parent to create secure attachment in your children, it's not the only important variable, but the single most important variable is the degree to which you as a parent have made sense of your own story. It is not about the parenting classes that you take. It is not about your genetics. It is about the degree to which you have made coherent sense of your own personal story. The degree to which, in other words, you yourself are living in a securely attached state of awareness as well. Because when I am, my hyper-awareness, for instance, that hyper-awareness, my awareness of the potential that I have to, you know, just bring destruction, is deeply related to my own shame, deeply related to my own story, deeply related to my own unregulated stuff that as of yet is not calmly embedded in a coherent narrative in which I can say, yes, this is true about my life, but those things have now been re-regulated because of the relationships that I have developed with people who are helping me make sense of me. As I make sense of me, I invariably help make sense for and with my kids. Does that make sense? Yeah, and the really good news about this is like it's work that we can do about our story. Okay? Yeah.
Hi, I'm reading currently in a book study looking at a book about racial reconciliation.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of seeing and hearing everything through the lens of race.
Right.
And so I have a question. It sounds like shame makes us want to hide, makes us want to separate. Can you maybe comment on how shame is systemic in the sense of like, do you think it contributes to like gentrification or segregation or racial divide?
Right. So that's a great question. Thank you. One of the things that I like to say about, and I don't hear this much from my other colleagues in the field, but one of the things that I like to say about states of integration, interpersonal neurobiology, and especially as it intersects with Christian spiritual formation, if you take seriously integration, it always, always leads to justice. Right? Justice is one of the primary political pillars of the biblical narrative. Not American justice, God's justice. Whole, integrated states lead to justice. And as N.T. Wright would say, justice in the biblical narrative is that God puts everything to right. God puts everything to live the way it was intended to be. That's what justice is. Shame, writ large, as we see in John 9, geometrically separates people. It separates the lawyers from the community, the family from their son from everybody else, meaning the blind guy, right? And invariably, whatever the groups are, blacks and whites, northerners and southerners, Jews and Arabs, whatever the groups are, I'm much more likely to, in this group, the very same thing that happens between myself and you now happens between us as the group and you as the group. And shame is at the core of this. Which is why, as we're going to see, like we said, that like creativity is born of vulnerability that takes place when two very disparately different parties, male and female, right? Because we can say, look, there's injustice between blacks and whites. There's injustice between Arabs and Jews. There's injustice between South Sudanese and North Sudanese. But there is not an older social institution of injustice than that between men and women. There's not an older one. And like we men, we are mostly the ones who don't get it. Yeah, just trying to be real. Yeah. Yeah, be real someplace else. But it's true, right? Like this, I mean this is the war that is the most ancient. And so the point being that like we have like and this is what evil does. Like it depends upon our not paying attention to this. It depends upon our staying separate. It depends upon our not confessing. It depends upon our not being vulnerable with one another in order to create. Look, racial reconciliation ultimately is not just about people being, different races being nice to each other. It is about co-creating things together that could not exist apart from that co-creating effort between two disparate and vulnerable parts. This is what God does when he comes to earth. The fact that he even creates this operation called Earth is all about a God who is deeply acquainted with what it means to be vulnerable. I don't know if that answers your question or not. All right.
Hi. My question regards to putting the clutch on after you have instilled shame on someone else,
right,
whether it's little kids or spouse or friends.
Right.
I'm thinking specifically, like, I've got a four-year-old, and so communication isn't the same with a four-year-old as it is with a spouse, but is there an equation of how to put the clutch on in the most useful way?
Is there an equation to put the clutch on?
Yeah, you gave your daughter's example of her coming in with the stereo, and right, you said you wouldn't spend some time talking through it, but there wasn't specifics on how you did that. So that's what I'm looking for is, when we know we've made an error and we've inflicted right shame, how do we go remedy that with, and what does that clutch look like?
Right. We're going to talk about that this afternoon. We are. What, yeah, figures. Yeah, one more answer this afternoon. Everything's coming. Yeah, we're going to do like 6 hours of work in 2 hours. Right, but that is a specific, and if somehow, like that, if I'm not specific enough this afternoon, we're going to have plenty of time for Q&A for that. Yeah, because we do want to address that. Okay. Yes.
In verse 7 in John 9, it says, Jesus said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam.
Uh-huh.
And it says, so he went away and washed and came back seeing. implying that the seeing doesn't happen until he obeys what Jesus told him to do. So you talked about how God comes in and enacts like healing on us in like this kind of really cool way, but I was also just wanting you to speak more on what he calls us to do and how we have this freedom and choice and our role in this.
Right, so the question is, what's our role in that healing process? Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, if you could expound more on verse 7 particularly.
Right, so thank you, our young biblical scholar, pointing this out. Believe me, like when I get the microphone, man, I just look for targets. So here's the thing. In the story of the 10 lepers, right, who were healed, the same thing happens, right? It's as they turn and go show yourselves to the priest. It's in the going that healing happens. It's in, Jesus says to him, like, go wash at the pool. And I'm thinking, like, dude, like, I'm blind. How am I going to see to get to the pool, right? And notice what he also doesn't do. He doesn't say, go and show yourself to the priest, which is also usurping the priest's role. Jesus is like, you just go to the priest and you're done. He doesn't say, go wash and then go to the priest. Just go wash. I want to suggest that when Jesus comes, he does not come forcibly. He does not come with your permission, but he does not come forcibly. He's going to come to those places where he is then going to invite us to go wash. There will be things, because here's the thing. Like I said yesterday, I would much rather this whole spiritual operation be much more like general surgery. They put you to sleep, they do the surgery, they wake you up, and it's heaven. But no, it's more like a rehab unit in which God very seriously wants us to participate in this action. The blind guy's action of walking away is an act of trust. Think about it. You've got mud on your face. It's bad enough that I'm blind sitting by the side of the road. Now I'm going to get up and find my way to a pool with mud on my face. Like, that's a lot of trust. Does that make sense? So there's no question that Jesus is going to ask us to expand our repertoire of behavior and courage in order to participate. God wants us to join him in this co-labored work of recreation. He takes us far more seriously than we take ourselves. Far more seriously. One more, because it's 12:02 and it's time for lunch.
I thought I wasn't going to have to ask.
Right, no pressure.
He just passed me. I'm reading a book called Rediscovering the Lost Mind and Body Connection.
Uh-huh.
And finding that even my fingertips have memory.
Uh-huh.
And I wondered if you were going to speak about how shame processes through the body, I mean, through the mind to the body in regard to disease. And I was also wondering,
in regard to disease, like what kind of disease?
If it just settles in a certain part of the body, in regard to shame. And the other part is if you were going to speak on the spirit of shame.
So two things. Explicitly, I'm probably not going to talk about the question about disease. Not because I don't want to, but we only have so much time to cover things. But I think perhaps to say, like we all kind of get it, right, that our experience of physical illness is deeply connected to our mind, right? So there's no question that if I'm carrying around if I'm doing a lot of work around shame, is it going to affect who I am physically? Well, of course it is, in some way, shape, or form, right? So we know that just in general. And as far as the spirit of shame is concerned, I'm not sure what we mean by the use of that word, right, the spirit of shame, in that, again, words are important, but they're symbols for things that we experience in real embodied forms, right? So, for instance, we would say, I do believe in an unseen world, right? N.T. Wright likes to talk about heaven being that dimension of reality that God occupies. That dimension of reality that God occupies. And earth is that dimension of reality that we occupy. And that in Jesus coming, there was this moment, years, in which heaven and earth are converging. Are you with me? And this sense that healing is all about God's Spirit coming to intersect with who we are, and who we are embodied broken people within whom shame operates. And it operates in a range of different ways that we've been talking about. Where that is, the spirit of shame, the soul of shame, whatever those words are that we're going to use, I don't know where, you know, we don't always know where the proper dividing lines are for that. But suffice to say that if in some respect by this afternoon, if we haven't covered what you mean by that, please ask again.